today is Dr. Bill Sook. So Dr. Sook is the director of both the Superfund Research Program and the Hazardous Substance Research Branch in the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, which is NIEHS, Division of Extramural Research and Training. He has served as the director of the SRP since it began. The SRP fosters interdisciplinary research approaches to address the problems associated with potentially hazardous environmental exposures. Dr. Sook received his PhD in microbiology from the George Washington University Medical School and his master's in public health and health policy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Gilling School of Global Public Health. So Dr. Sook, I will now turn this over to you.
Are we good? Okay. We good? I'm waiting for it to come up. Uh-oh.
Okay.
All right. I'm just waiting. Okay, there we go. Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate it. And welcome, everyone. It is my pleasure to open this webinar series. And I'm going to run through a few things about the Superfund research program and some of the exciting research that we are supporting that addresses the issues of complex exposures to hazardous substances. So the NIEHS, the NIEHS is an institute of the National Institutes of Health. Its Superfund program funds university-based multidisciplinary research on human health, on human health and environmental issues related to hazardous substances. The central goal is to understand and break the link between chemical exposure and disease. The Superfund research program is conducted in accordance with the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA, of 1986. The mandates specified in SARA described the program's primary objectives to be the development of, and each one of these is listed here as part of as our mandates, methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment, advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of the effects on human health of hazardous substances, methods to assess the risks to human health presented by hazardous substances, and D, which is unique, very unique to a program at NIH, development of basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and or toxicity of hazardous substances. These are broad mandates and that provide us with our ability to support multidisciplinary research. Our program is specifically not site-specific, so that the research and the training that we support under this program can be generalizable or used in a variety of situations across the country and in some cases across the world. Also, I might mention that if you notice, I use the word hazardous substances, which again gives us a much broader mandate to look at things that need to be addressed for the problems that we're going to be faced with in the future. So let me change that. Okay. Assessing the complex challenges posed by hazardous substances and mixtures of chemicals requires an integrated multidisciplinary approach. This slide demonstrates the use of multiple funding mechanisms to support research, including individual research grants at NIH, that's R01s, small business research grants, SBIR, training and educational programs, and multi-project centers. The SRP multi-project centers are the mainstay of the program and bring together many disciplines in the same center to bear on these complex issues. Each multi-project center includes a variety of health and environmental disciplines, shown here, as well as training, community engagement, and research translation. They're all tied together and integrated under a unifying theme, which helps to capture the complexity of hazardous waste sites and hazardous substances across disciplines. This unifying theme at each center links the projects in different research domains. Some centers are linked with a unified theme related to specific contaminants or groups of chemicals like arsenic and mercury or PAHs. A few other examples of themes relate to nutrition and Superfund toxicity, risk assessment, development, and reproductive toxicity of Superfund chemicals, etc. In keeping with the NIEHS mission, diverse teams of professionals develop, test, and implement unique solution-oriented approaches to address complex environmental health problems. They are improving the understanding of environmental contaminants, which may lead to lower environmental cleanup costs, reduced risk of exposure, and improvement in human health and well-being. In response to the Toxic Substances Control Act amended under the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act, there's a mouthful, federal agencies, including the US EPA and the National Toxicology Program, have begun focusing on new approaches for evaluating the safety of chemicals by reducing the use of traditional animal models. This includes development of rapid tools to evaluate exposure and potential health risks, as well as approaches to integrate these methods to evaluate risk. Assessing environmental exposure and identifying health hazards are both important aspects of chemical safety and evaluation, and rapid screening tools may be used to improve our understanding of both aspects. SRP grantees are doing research related to both of these aspects. You may have already heard about some of this work in the first two sessions, and you will hear more of it today. The SRP is well positioned to lead the way in the 21st century science project human health. Okay. By combining interdisciplinary expertise, our grantees have been successful in developing alternative models to identify hazards, making progress in disentangling the many questions and uncertainties related to chemical mixtures. They are also creating cutting-edge, rapid screening tools for environmental assessment and toxicity testing, and developing 3D models that mimic biological conditions. There are many SRP researchers developing new approaches and alternatives for toxicity, fate and transport, and ecotoxicity testing. I am just going to be providing a few examples of how SRP grantees are advancing 21st century science to protect human health. Links with more information on each of these examples are available on the slides posted on the CLUIN page of this webinar. Several SRP grantees are using zebrafish to advance the use of 21st century science in toxicity testing. The clear embryo of the zebrafish allows researchers to visualize the anatomical changes associated with development, which makes them a useful model for understanding the structural and chemical effects of neurotoxicants, as well as behavioral impairments associated with exposures. This is a really interesting approach when you can actually visualize the changes taking place. The SRP grantees at the University of Washington have developed a panel of zebrafish genes that can be combined with a rapid testing platform to identify chemicals that induce oxidative stress. The method, optimized for use in larval zebrafish, is cost-effective and can be performed more quickly and with less tissue than conventional methods. SRP grantees at Duke University, SRP Center, demonstrated in zebrafish that polybrominated diphenyl ethers and halogenated phenolic compounds can bind proteins that regulate thyroid hormones and bone development. Their work highlighted the importance of studying intermediate life stages and chemical mixtures, since embryonic and adult studies may not be predictive of toxicity when exposures occur in developing juvenile life stages. SRP grantees at Oregon State University Superfund Center use zebrafish to define the toxicity of complex polyaromatic hydrocarbon mixtures. According to researchers, the zebrafish model there is uniquely situated and suited to link biomedical, genetic, and cellular changes to observations at the structural, functional, and behavioral levels in a high-throughput format. If you'd like to learn more about what Oregon State's work on zebrafish, you can view the archive of Lisa Truong's presentation from session one on this series. It really is very interesting. So we have SRP grantees that are working to understand how contaminants harm the environment and other organisms, basically new tools for studying ecotoxicology. Boston University, SRP Center, researchers at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute have explored the complex genetics involved in how Atlantic killifish have rapidly evolved to tolerate normally lethal levels of environmental contaminants in polluted East Coast estuaries, providing new information about the mechanisms of environmental chemical toxicity in both animals and humans. Using approaches that integrate molecular and biochemical, physiological, and behavioral endpoints, University of Washington SRP researchers are investigating how exposure to metals such as cadmium may impact regional survival of fish. This includes mechanisms by which cadmium and copper exposure can lead to damage to the olfactory system of fish. Finally, on this slide, researchers at Brown University Superfund Center have developed a new 3D liver cell model that can be used to screen chemicals for toxicity in fish. The model uses fish liver cells cultured to form 3D microtissues so researchers can assess liver toxicants over time after single or repeated exposures. Compared to a single layer of cells often used in toxicology, 3D liver microtissues live longer and are better differentiated, acting more like real livers, and can better predict the response of fish. If you'd like to learn more about the 3D liver model from Brown University, you can view the archive of April Rhodes, it's right there, from session one. Again, this is a really fascinating tool to use, and I encourage you to look at it if you haven't already seen it. Okay. Our researchers, our grantees, are developing tests using cells and antibodies to screen for hazardous chemicals in the environment and in human samples. Here I'm going to provide you with two examples. Texas A&M Superfund Research Program Center grantees at Baylor University are developing rapid imaging platforms and custom automated web-based image analysis and reporting tools to identify the presence of endocrine disrupting chemicals in complex chemical mixtures. The researchers are developing cost-effective tools that can be used to quickly assess the risks to human health during natural and man-made environmental emergencies. Next is the researchers at University of Davis Superfund Research Program are using VHH antibodies, which are binding fragments of antibodies, to develop immunoassays to detect polychlorinated biphenyls, pesticides, and other compounds and degradation products. These immunoassays, which use VHH antibodies isolated, get this, from alpacas, really, are fast, sensitive, high throughput, and low cost. Alpacas. Cool. All right. Understanding how chemicals move through and change in the environment are important to identifying potential exposures. SRP grantees are developing rapid screening and other tools to improve our understanding of exposure and environmental fate of contaminants. Researchers from Brown University SRP Center have developed process models to predict vapor concentrations that enter indoor environments, providing a simpler, accurate screening method to determine whether chemicals in the underground sources are seeping into buildings and contaminating indoor air. At the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Program Center, researchers have incorporated multiple lines of evidence, including soil gas measurements and a 3D model to better evaluate exposure risks from vapor intrusion into homes and buildings. These two programs are working together to address this particular problem. As part of the MIT SRP Center, researchers are developing a new method to assess the pathways that transport PAHs in the environment using spatial and temporal tracking. In the atmosphere, PAHs can be quickly transported and can be transformed, creating products that may be of lower or higher toxicity than the original compounds. To better understand these processes, the approach integrates state-of-the-art sensors, laboratory studies, and modeling of contaminant chemistry to predict PAH concentration fate. At University of Rhode Island, SRP Center, researchers are using novel statistical methods to fingerprint poly and furfural alkyl substances. There are many types of these substances with different sources and different effects. They are looking at PFAS profiles from wastewater around a contaminated site and comparing them to PFAS profiles in fish and drinking water to better understand the exposure. University of Pennsylvania SRP researchers are identifying how asbestos forms aggregates and moves through the groundwater. Recent findings indicate that the diffusion rates of asbestos, as well as a wide range of natural particles, can be predicted by taking the specific particle shape into account. So SRP-funded researchers are also developing new ways to identify hazards and evaluate chemical safety. This includes novel computational approaches to understand how humans are exposed to chemicals, how they might interact in the body, and how differences between humans play a role. These approaches also have the potential to help scientists evaluate the combined effects of mixtures of chemicals that people are exposed to. For example, at Boston University's SRP Center, researchers developed a computational pipeline to construct chemical networks. They have shown that by grouping chemicals based on the similarity of their associated networks, they can identify groups of chemicals or drugs with similar functions and similar profiles that may damage genes and lead to cancer. These networks can also point to the main molecular pathways triggered by specific chemicals. I'm going to talk about pathways in a minute. Second example here is Texas A&M SRP Center grantees at the DOE Pacific Northwest Laboratory have developed a novel platform that can rapidly and automatically analyze environmental samples. Erin Baker presented this approach in session two of this series. She discussed how this platform is a viable way to screen for chemicals in the environment and in biological samples for insight into human exposure and disease mechanisms. Here we have some additional computational methods being developed by SRP researchers. Researchers at UC Berkeley SRP Center found that using a platform to map the reactivity of environmental chemicals across all the proteins in the body may uncover new ways environmental chemicals interact in humans. They're using reactivity-based strategies to uncover distinct sets of proteins and pathways sensitive to environmental chemicals, informing how molecules interact in the body and how they might be linked to chemical toxicity. Using cell-based data, Texas A&M SRP Center grantees developed a computational approach to estimate differences in susceptibility to chemicals based on population variability or on the genetic differences normally found within a population. You will hear more about this in the presentation by Wei-Shui Chu coming up next. These new methods are enabling us to evaluate how chemicals affect biological pathways or networks of interactions between molecules that together perform biological functions. This includes how chemicals perturb molecules that are part of a pathway, as well as how chemicals perturb interactions within a pathway. These pathway responses reveal important mechanistic information. By combining data on biological pathways known to be associated with health effects with data on chemical classes linked to disruptions in key biological events that lead to those health effects, we can better understand the link between environmental and between the environment and environmental exposures and disease. Again, going back to the original premise behind this program, to be able to develop methods to understand the link between exposure and disease and to break that link. As we move forward, leveraging the wealth of knowledge that alternative models provide and integrating data from the new innovative approaches, we will address knowledge gaps and improve what we know about how complex exposures lead to disease. As knowledge of biological methods continues to evolve, SRP researchers are also developing better computational models that integrate in vivo, in vitro, and in silico data that can be incredibly useful in evaluating the safety of chemicals. Fundamental research approaches I've discussed today have the ability to challenge the current paradigm of risk assessment. Rather than making presumptions about what chemicals are causing risk, as is the current approach to assessing risk requires, new approaches, such as metabolomics, enable researchers to investigate which chemicals are associated with risk. Because the associations do not prove anything by themselves, researchers must follow up by mechanistically testing the resulting hypotheses in order to understand the mechanisms of toxicity. SRP is in a unique position because we have data from a variety of scientific disciplines, from a variety of platforms, data platforms For 30 years, the SRP has been bringing together research domains that do not normally meet under the same roof to provide and take advantage of different perspectives to solve complex problems. Again, one needs to be able to address these problems in an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary way, and that's the basis of this program. We want to take that to the next level and integrate diverse data from a variety of fields, from engineering to microbiology, to understand and break the link between exposure and disease. Ultimately, by integrating and sharing data across these different research domains, we will enhance the knowledge base, enhancing environmental health solutions through data integration, reducing the burden of disease, and improving public health. In addition to this series, I want to make you aware of the two other recent SRP Risk e-Learning series that are relevant to advancing 21st century science. One series on advancing outcome pathways, and one series on analytical tools and methods. The archives of each of these sessions are available from the SRP Risk e-Learning website. I encourage you to look at them if you haven't already done so. With that, I would like to thank Cluin for hosting us and for all of their support. I would also like to thank our colleagues who were members of the Planning Committee for this webinar series. I am very excited to hear about the excellent work being done by today's other two presenters. Before we move to the next session or the next speaker, I would like to personally thank the members of this seminar preparing series: Marcy Card from the US EPA, Warren Casey and Nicole Kleinstreuer from NTP, National Toxicology Program, Jim Rice and Jesse Nealon from Gradient. Lastly, we thank again Cluin and for hosting the Risky Serving Series. I would also like to thank my staff for putting this all together, and I would like to pass it off to Michelle to introduce our next speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sook. We enjoyed listening to all the great research that's going on in our program, and we encourage you all to visit our website if you want to learn more. Unfortunately, Dr. Sook has to run to another meeting, but if you do have any questions for him, let us know, and we'd be happy to pass those along to him. So next up in the queue is Dr. Wei-Shui Chu. Dr. Chu is a professor in the Department of Veterinarian Integrative Biosciences at Texas A&M University, where he's actively involved in research, teaching, and service in the areas of toxicology, chemical risk assessment, and regulatory science. He received his bachelor's degree in physics from Harvard University and earned a PhD in physics from Princeton University, as well as a certificate in science, technology, and environmental policy from the Woodrow Wilson School. Dr. Chu spent the first 16 years of his career in government school service, beginning at the U.S. Government Accountability Office and then at the U.S. EPA. Throughout his career, he's been involved in a diverse span of risk-related topics such as defense against chemical biological warfare agents, radioactive contamination in biosolids, human health risks from environmental chemical exposures, and the interface between science and policy. His recent research has focused on human health risk assessment, particularly with respect to toxicokinetics, mechanisms of toxicity, and physiological-based pharmacokinetic modeling, dose response assessment, and characterizing uncertainty and variability. He has a particular interest in the development and use of Bayesian and probabilistic methods. Dr. Chu has served on a variety of expert review panels, thinking about those llamas, for federal and state government agencies, as well as work groups for the World Health Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Health Canada, and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. So we're pleased to have Dr. Chu present for us, and I will turn it over to you now.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Can everyone hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay, great. So I'm going to dive a little deeper into one aspect of the complexity that Dr. Sook mentioned, gave an overview for, and that is addressing sort of population variability and susceptibility. So first, let me just say that I don't have any conflicts of interest. I don't have any commercial affiliations or commercial benefits from any of the work that I'm presenting. So to outline my presentation, first I'm going to talk a little bit about the motivation of why we need to address population variability and susceptibility in risk assessment and in toxicity testing and ultimately for things like cleanup for as this series is directed at. I'm going to talk about some opportunities to use a number of the emerging in vivo, in vitro, and in silico population models in order to address some key risk assessment issues along this dimension of variability and susceptibility. I'll talk about hazard identification and mechanisms, as well as dose response assessment. And then at the end, I'm going to talk briefly about some challenges in risk characterization as we learn more about variability and susceptibility. So why should we care about population variability and susceptibility? Well, so most people in toxicology have heard of Paracelsus, about the dose makes the poison. But about 1,300 years before that, one of the really fathers of medicine after Hippocrates is this physician Galen of Pergamum, who basically foreshadowed the whole gene-environment interaction idea. He said that, remember throughout, that no external cause is efficient without a predisposition in the body itself. Otherwise, external causes which affect one would affect all. So we all know that not all smokers get lung cancer. Everyone who's exposed to air pollution in the city, not all of them die of a heart attack. So there's always an interaction between the environment and our genes and the variability and diversity we see in the population. So how do we deal with that in risk assessment? Well, right now, really what we do is divide by 10. This is the general paradigm for deriving a reference dose, which is often used as a benchmark for cleanup or remediation. And really, this is usually defined as a NOAEL derived from an experimental study. You divide by 10 once to get for adjust from animals to humans, and then you adjust by divide by 10 again to account for human variability. So, how can we do better than this? Is 10 enough? What does the 10 really mean? We want to be able to explore this more, and a lot of the work techniques and models that have been developed in the last 5 or 10 years are being aimed at trying to explore this further. Because, to date, we really don't have a good handle on characterizing this variability. On the left here is the classic source to outcome continuum, where you start with something in some sort of concentration in the environment, people get exposed, the toxicokinetics leads to internal exposure, toxodynamics leads to various types of biological responses, and then the whole sort of system dynamics leads ultimately to some type of physiological or health status change. And the types of data that we have to explore different parts of the source-to-outcome continuum are shown here, in that we have epidemiologic studies, animal bioassays, toxokinetic models, and more recently, more in vitro assays and toxicity pathway information, as well as adverse outcome pathways, which was mentioned earlier and for which there was an earlier series. But each of these is quite limited in its ability to address this question of variability. Epidemiologic and clinical studies, first, they're fairly limited in their coverage of chemicals, but they are also very limited in their power to examine the question of how variable or whether there are particularly susceptible subpopulations. Additionally, many of particularly epidemiologic studies and many clinical studies are in occupational or patient cohorts that don't necessarily generalize to the whole population, which includes a much more diverse diverse range of genetics and health status and age and et cetera. Animal bioassays are available for more chemicals than epidemiologic studies. There's, of course, the uncertainty related to interspecies differences, but even the animal bioassays themselves are almost exclusively performed in homogeneous experimental animal systems. So as Linda Birnbaum often says, in an animal study, you're testing a model of at most one human being. So, how do we generalize that to the entire population? Toxokinetic models, again, are available for maybe 100 or so chemicals. Now there's some efforts to do, more high throughput toxokinetic modeling. But again, there's few examples of analyzing population variability, although there are some of the more recent work has begun to address this, and I'll talk about this briefly later. The recent trend towards going to high throughput in terms of in vitro assays, now we're testing up to maybe 10,000 chemicals in the TOX21 program. But again, almost all of these assays, if they're cell-based, even are genetically homogeneous in a single cell line without accounting for variability. Adverse outcome pathways, this is, sort of just an emerging area, and really, variability and susceptibility has not really been included in the concept of how we define these pathways. The end result is that for toxicity values and risk characterization, things that are needed sort of on the ground to make risk management decisions, most of them don't do more than divide by 10 to address variability and susceptibility. So this is basically our paradigm here. We have animals, in vitro data, in silico data that we extrapolate to make some inference about humans, and usually that's thought of as a prediction for some average male or female human. And then we try to go from that average individual to a prediction for a variable population. And really the how we go from a very homogeneous system to predictions for a variable population is the main challenge that we face. Fortunately, in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been this challenge has been recognized, and there's been a number of new approaches and tools that have been developed and are being explored to try to better characterize this variability. The first is these genetically diverse mouse populations, looking at a diversity panel, which is a panel of different inbred strains. So you test or you do experiments across a number of different inbred strains. And then a number of sort of designed populations, the collaborative cross and the diversity outbred, and I'll describe those in a moment, that are specifically designed to address population variability. Second is the use of populations of human cells, not only cell lines. I'll describe some work related to the 1,000 Genomes Project, where 1,000 different cell lines were tested with many different chemicals to look at the range of variability across the population. And then, more recently, use of induced pluripotent stem cells has the potential to really sort of revolutionize the examination of variability and susceptibility. And then all of these are now requiring computational modeling of populations, sort of more sophisticated modeling approaches that address the variability and diversity across the experimental system. So I'm going to start with hazard identification. So why is it, what is the challenge? Well, because we're using single strain rodent models for most of the toxicity testing, you know, the question of human relevance always comes up. And this is both for positive and negative findings in these homogeneous systems. You know, is a positive result, is that positive result going to be reproduced in humans? And then if the result is negative, well, how sure are we that that actually would be negative in humans? And then, of course, you know, with only a single inbred strain, there's no way to really extrapolate from, you know, across the population. So what if we use a population-based model? So the hypothesis is that we have across the whole species of mice, for instance, there are some mice that are better models for humans than others. You know, so some poor models and some good models for humans. And as we make an extrapolation from mice to humans, then if we, you know, are unlucky in choosing, you know, bad models, then we're going to have responses that are outside the range of human responses. And so by using multiple strains, then we sort of increase the chance of having good models of humans and reduce the chance of picking a poor model. And then as a side benefit, we also obtain information about the range of population variability. So does this really work? Well, so first a little bit about some of these populations. So this was from a review by Allison Harrell and Camille McAllister. So the original, the first paradigm here was this mouse diversity panel, which used a panel of different conventional inbred strains. Then this panel was actually, a number of strains were selected for actually developing a designed population. And that is, they were crossed over many generations to have them so that each, so that there's a real mixture of the original eight strains, and then each of those crosses eventually was then developed into an inbred strain. So now we have inbred, more than 100 individual inbred strains. So we have reproducibility in that we have an inbred strain that we can go back to over and over again, but we have, you know, several hundred of these so that we can look at population variability. And then we can also cross those individually as well. And then another model that came out of this was what's called the diversity outbred, in which the one of the generations was taken and then just randomly bred so that there's constant random hybridization across the population. And so here, this is almost like, you know, having a, you know, doing epidemiology in mice. You have a population of unique individuals and you can look at effects across the population. So why are these models good? Well, you know, just even looking at baseline characteristics over on the left here, you can see that there's a much greater variation across this population than if you were to use a single inbred strain. So on the left is actually running distance overnight. So each of the mice was given a little wheel to run on, and they could choose to run it or not. And this is the average number of kilometers they ran just spontaneously overnight over a number of different replicas. So you can see on the left, there's basically the couch potato mice, which really just want to sit around and not do anything. And then you have the people, the individual mice on the right, the strains who really love running, and these are the marathon runners. And interestingly, this range is much greater than even the range of the individual inbred strains. So we already are reproducing a wide range of baseline characteristics, just like in the human population, there's a wide range of baseline health status and different dispositions. And then in the middle here, on the bottom, this is an example with Ebola, where mouse has been thought of as a poor model for Ebola, but when they looked across 47 strains, they found that there's actually a diversity of different types of phenotypic outcomes with mice. So there's people with lethality and hemorrhage, there's lethality without hemorrhage, and then there's mice who are resistant. I'm sorry, some of the shading didn't quite come out in the transfer over to Adobe Connect. And this really reproduces the range of phenotypic outcomes you see in human populations. And this was based on a particular outbreak with a number with hemorrhage, with lethality and hemorrhage, and then a number with lethality without hemorrhage, and a number that are resistant or partially resistant. So this encouraged the community that this could be used, that having a population of mice could often maybe rescue the mouse as a model, because by having this genetic diversity, we actually are being able to reproduce the diversity of outcomes in the human population. And so this has, with the, if we look now at a xenobiotic, this is with acetaminophen, where the acetaminophen was administered both to six different inbred mouse strains at a lower dose, 37 different strains at a higher dose, and then human data in between. And the point here is that, well, first, humans have, some people don't have any liver toxicity, and some actually have, seven or eight-fold serum ALT changes, indicating a fairly strong response in terms of liver toxicity. And we get, qualitatively the same type of effect in mice, particularly at this higher dose amongst the 37 different strains. But even here, there are some strains that are just resistant. And if we were to test some new compound and happen to pick the wrong strain, then we would completely miss this hazard. So that's sort of the proof of principle as to why this is, should be a better, more accurate approach to toxicity testing. So in terms of mechanisms of toxicity, the issue with looking at mechanisms, is, particularly and experimentally, for instance, knockout studies, they only probe one thing at a time. And it's difficult to distinguish in these experimental systems between interspecies susceptibility differences, as in the variability, or between different species, and the intraspecies variability due to different differences within the population. Because the general idea is that, of course, genes and environment interact to produce toxicity, and the hypothesis here is that genes and pathways associated with susceptibility or resistance will also be associated with those same pathways for environmental factors, so that we can use the genetics to kind of probe, what is the mechanisms for toxicity. And again, this has seen a proof of principle with acetaminophen. So they essentially treated this mouse population as like a human population and did genome-wide association study and found a gene for CD44, this candidate susceptibility gene, that they then went back and looked in human epidemiologic or clinical cohorts and saw that indeed differences in this gene in humans led to differences in the response to acetaminophen. Then, looking at this gene closer, it provided insights into the mechanism of toxicity. And that, so acetaminophen is hepatotoxic, a few cells will die, but depending on the CD44 status, some will just go on to recover, and if there's a different CD44 status, then it will lead to apoptosis and inflammation, and that is actually what leads to more severe types of liver toxicity. So this type of using these population-based models can actually provide insights into the mechanisms of both toxicity and the susceptibility across the population. So I'm going to close with discussing the dose response, which is, arguably for, I saw that most of the people on the call are either state or local or federal government or, consultants involved in sort of the day-to-day decision-making and risk characterization that's needed for, cleanup. So dose response is really where the action is in terms of actually any of this information making a true impact on how changing how we go about remediating sites, et cetera. So, the current approach is really we assume that a single strain is representative of the population. We assume these tenfold factors are adequate to be protective, and we don't have a lot of assurance as to how good that really is. So, you know, the first example is with toxicokinetics. That's sort of been the most the best worked out, and even before some of the more recent resources have been developed. And here, you know, population-based, physiologically-based pharmacokinetic models have been, you know, used for, you know, probably over a decade, and, you know, maybe up to two decades in a few cases to try to examine this population variability question. So I'm going to give an example with trichloroethylene. This is work I did almost 10 years ago at EPA, and that was incorporated into the TCE iris assessment. And the idea then is to use a Bayesian population model to look at where we have individual data across about 50 individuals, and then we can make predictions based on this model as to how variable the population is. So here, this is depending on the different, whether you're talking about oxidation or particular metabolite, TCA, or the GSH conjugation metabolites, the amount of human variability can vary depending on what the toxic moiety is. So this was data, these are predictions that are based on actual human data. So this is not gonna happen very much because we don't have a lot of human data on toxicokinetics. So the question is, can we develop an experimental model that can mimic this, the human population, and still get reasonable estimates for human variability? So our hypothesis then was we could use this mouse, this panel of mice of different mouse strains to model the variability in the human population. And so we adapted this same PBPK model for mice, and Dr. Yvonne Rusin's lab collected toxicokinetic data on 17 different strains, and then we would calibrate the model and see if the results seem reasonable and correspond with the results that we have from human data. So the results are here, and there's two points. One is that the mouse interstrain variability essentially reproduces almost exactly the human interindividual variability that was estimated from human data. So for this dose metric of oxidation, you know, it's basically about 1.1 the factor of variability. For TCA, it's about a factor of 2, and then for GSH conjugation, it's about a factor of 7. And this ratio, this number is the ratio between the 95th percentile most sensitive and the median individual or strain. So this gives us some faith that perhaps we can use these mouse populations in order to, as a surrogate for human population variability. The second point is that in both these cases, the traditional strain that's used, B6C3F1, is an outlier. It's not a typical one across all the different strains. And so that emphasizes the point that when you use single individual mouse strains, you might underestimate the actual sort of species central tendency. What about toxodynamics? So this is where there's been essentially no work done in the past because it's so difficult to estimate toxodynamic variability. Bill Sook mentioned earlier the use of the different cell lines, and so that seemed like the most easily accessible approach because when you use when you do things in vitro, you're testing the concentration response. And so you really are looking at the toxodynamic portion of this variability. So this was work that was done by one of the experiments were done in collaboration with NCATS and took basically 1,000 cell lines from 1,000 different individuals across from populations across the globe, and then were tested with about 170 different compounds in concentration response. And so the idea here is to look at what's called this toxodynamic variability factor, which is what is the ratio between the concentration that would start to kill cells in the most sensitive individuals versus in the typical individual. And so these are some examples here with viability on the y-axis and then concentration on the x-axis. And so over on the left here, the cadmium chloride, you know, most of the cells are responding fairly similarly across all the, you know, for this compound across the different cell lines. Whereas over on the right with these mercury compounds, you know, some cells are very, very sensitive and some are very resistant, and leading to a very wide range of variability. So, you know, this was all conducted using, you know, Bayesian modeling in order to really account for both the variability across different cell lines as well as the uncertainty due to, you know, experimental variation. As you can see, this is really chemical specific. So for the typical toxodynamic uncertainty factor of 3 would certainly be inadequate for these mercury compounds, but it would be, you know, sufficiently conservative for this cadmium chloride compound on the left. So, you know, this is all well and good. We have these estimates, but does this have anything to do with reality? So what we did, we compared with what limited human data there was in vivo on toxodynamic variability. And that is, you know, mostly work by Dale Haddis of Clark University, where he combed through the literature and tried to look for, you know, data on how, where you had both serum measurements and some sort of toxic endpoint, and see, you know, what's the range of serum concentrations you need to elicit a certain response. And so that comparison is here. So the in vitro data for the 170 chemicals and using the 1,000 different cell lines is in red, and then the in vivo data from De Haddis's work is in black. So, you know, these distributions substantially overlap, and, you know, they're not statistically significantly different. And as you can see, you know, the typical chemical has this factor of about 3, which amazingly corresponds to what the default is. But the range above or below that is quite wide. So, you know, 3 is not a conservative number for protecting, you know, making sure that the sensitive part of the population is protected. But, you know, 3 is more of sort of a typical number. So these, of course, are cell lines. These are these are lymphoblastoid cells. So the next step really is to move towards specific cell types. And here there's, because of the advances in induced pluripotent stem cell technology, there's a real opportunity here to look across different cell lines and then across different individuals, different tissues and across different individuals. So, you know, molecular devices CDI, cellular dynamics, they've been developing these different types of cell lines from induced pluripotent stem cells, and a variety of different types of endpoints can be measured from each of these. So in addition, we have work with sponsored by EPA to look specifically at cardiomyocytes and looking across about 40 different individuals. And we do see a range of variability in terms of their response to various xenobiotics in terms of the effects on heart rhythm. So I'm going to close with just a few statements about some challenges in terms of risk characterization. And as we explore, you know, variability and the uncertainties associated with them more, we begin, you know, we sort of have peeled back the onion in that, you know, these reference doses and these exposure limits are not, although thought of as safe, they're not 100% risk-free. Well, first, you could never achieve 100% certainty in anything. Variability, in terms of variability, you can never ensure that 100% of the population is protected because there's always some tail of the distribution that you don't have data for, potentially don't have data for. So we, you know, well, the challenge here is to sort of get out of the head in the sand kind of, you know, approach that we've had in terms of really acknowledging that these are not purely completely risk-free, and that we need to actually make some risk management decisions as to what level of uncertainty we can accept and what level of protection in terms of what proportion of the population we feel is adequate to be protective of. And this gets at, you know, some of the work on probabilistic dose response modeling that I've been doing in collaboration with the WHO work group. And this has actually just been accepted a few days ago, But you know, we can actually use these approaches to try to assess what is the risk at the reference dose. And here, the top set of curves is, you know, for the upper confidence bound on the incidence of effect as a function of the hazard quotient. So this dotted line going up and down is a hazard quotient of 1, and looking across about 600 chemicals and over 1,500 endpoints, you can see that, you know, the upper confidence limit of the incidence at a hazard quotient of 1, you know, ranges from essentially negligible to, you know, a fairly large percentage of the population potentially being affected. And, you know, the other aspect of it is that, you know, look, not all reference doses are created equal. You know, some of these are based on, you know, very mild effects, like clinical chemistry changes, but some of them are based on very severe effects, like hemorrhage or atrophy or mortality even. So, you know, this first of all confirms that the reference dose is not a risk-free exposure level, and never really was intended to be, but this sort of puts a harder point on it, and then suggests that we can actually do something about this by taking a more probabilistic approach, acknowledging these uncertainties as well as the range of variability to try to actually, be more precise in how we're defining these exposure limits. And then finally, with the final challenge is that these emerging data methods, particularly related to induced pluripotent stem cells, have the potential to really identify who might remain at risk. And, you know, that's challenging for a number of reasons. You know, first, many of our risk-based policies presume that we can't identify who might be subject to this residual risk. You know, although there is a precedent in terms of, you know, people can go online and calculate their own cardiovascular risk profiles. So maybe there's a way to address this, sort of a personalized risk assessment kind of thing, rather as opposed to personalized medicine. But then, you know, what if we are then testing people's individual cells for toxicity so we can figure out, each individual, what they might be more or less susceptible to? What is sort of the implications of that in terms of risk management and policy? So just some things to think about. So to summarize, there's, you know, a lot of challenges to addressing population variability and haven't really done a very good job about it in the past, but there's multiple opportunities for improvement. Using some of these new population-based experimental resources combined with computational modeling that incorporates the population variability. And that's both for hazard identification mechanisms as well as a number of opportunities in dose response assessment. But these then bring on these challenges in terms of how do we communicate and what kind of policies we need to develop in order to characterize risk and manage risk with this additional new information. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention.
Great, Raceway. That was a great presentation, a lot of information there. We've had some questions that have come through the Q&A pod. So I'll get started with those, and then I'll open it up to the phone lines. So the question, and one of these really evolved as you were speaking, and it was fun just to see how the question changed. But I think how it ended is, does the use of genetically variable mouse populations decrease the sensitivity in animal studies so that more animals would be required to maintain the sensitivity with the genetic homogeneous mice? And kind of connected with that, could it be argued that 37 genetic inbred mouse model overpredict variability, which was 100 or 1,000-fold for that population and 10-fold for humans? Did you get that, or do you need to repeat it?
I got the first part. So I think the question of sample size and, you know, efficient use of resources is a struggle. And, you know, I guess I think some additional, we need to have a better sense of, like, well, part of it is a fit-for-purpose thing. If we, you know, if we're looking at worrying about false positives and false negatives, I think we need more data to see whether the, you know, the traditional homogeneous models we've been using are really, you know, how bad is it in terms of false positives and false negatives, and whether there would be benefit for going to a diverse population. But the other, one of the things that might help that is that if we're committed to benchmark dose modeling rather than just pairwise statistical tests, then that actually can help in terms of the statistical power. For instance, even for single strains, it's been shown that if you're committed to doing the dose response modeling rather than pairwise comparison, you have greater power by having a single replicate for many, many, many dose groups rather than smaller number of dose groups and more replicates. So I think there's work to be done there. In terms of the overprediction, I wasn't sure where the thousandfold was coming from.
That's because I wasn't clear. I apologize. So that was actually, I got clarification as you were giving that first answer. So that was regarding the acetaminophen study that you showed. So just the variability that you saw that was 1,000-fold for the mouse population versus 10-fold for the humans.
Right. So that is partially a product of the fact that those mice actually were at very high doses. And so the variability might have ballooned because of that. That study didn't have exactly comparable doses across humans and animals, so it was a little bit difficult to compare. The work on trichloroethylene for toxokinetics, at least, showed very similar variability in 17 strains of mice as with about 50 humans. And then, I think we need some more case studies to kind of, confirm that we're not over-predicting variability. I don't think it's necessarily as dire as that particular graph.
Okay. We have a related question to this acetaminophen study that you showed, and it was asking if you've considered metabolism into the variability in the liver toxicity. Given that it's a toxic metabolite that's causing the liver damage.
Right. So for those studies, the metabolism wasn't included. There was no toxicokinetic measurement to go along with it. So it was purely kind of more of a clinical empirical observation.
Okay. There was also someone asking a question about the probability of feasibility extending sort of this idea of the diversity strains that you're looking at. And so this question was, how can similar principles be used with microbiome diversity to look for differences in toxicity based on microbiomes?
That's a great question. And I'm afraid I haven't thought about that at all. In terms of the microbiome. So the limitation here is that this is just genetic variability and host genetic variability, I guess you should say, and doesn't account for all the other sources of variability that we have based on, behaviors, our environment, more broadly in terms of our nutrition, our upbringing, socioeconomic status, things like that actually have been shown to affect susceptibility, but aren't addressed here. So microbiome is another thing to add to that list in terms of the things that are not addressed in these models. Although I have heard that maybe for zebrafish there is there have been at least some proposals to look at microbiome. And microbiome-free zebrafish and looking at differences there. But I'm not really familiar with that literature.
Okay, thank you. Another question related to the surprise with the CD44 finding. And extending from that, with all the variability that you're seeing across, mouse populations and human populations, could this be boiled down to just a set of pathways? So kind of regardless of maybe the chemical or maybe not, are you seeing that that's what's happening? So for instance, with the liver finding, the CD or CD44 had a big role whether or not cells were able to recover. Are you seeing things like that, or do you have the possibility to see things like that with your system?
I think the hope is that because for the mice and for the lymphoblastoid in cells, for the cells and genomes, these have been sequenced. So I think it's expensive to do all the transcriptomics and all that kind of thing, but for gene expression. But they have been sequenced. So people do try to do sort of genetic association. And as we have more, what we need is more chemicals to look at, so that we have more information to be able to sort of generalize as to whether there are certain types of pathways, interrogated through their genetics that, sort of modulate the susceptibility.
Okay, thank you. So I will also open this up to the phone line. So if anyone wants to ask a question through the phone line, please take your phone off mute by pressing #6. I'll just give just a few seconds for you all to catch up with that. If you have a question, just feel free to begin asking it. Okay, so we have as we're waiting for people to come through for the phone line, we have another question that's come through the Q&A pod. And it's a long one, so Weishui, bear with me, please. So given the complexity of characterizing risk and still almost total reliance on older risk assessment methods, how can NIHS help move the paradigm of industrial chemical production and use towards green chemistry? So this might be for us a little bit. In other words, we need the public to understand that there are no direct benefits to human health to have industrial chemicals in your blood, brain, and that their presence is an artifact or indirect benefits. Let me see if I can parse this down. I think if we could tie the limitations of risk assessment to more pollution prevention opportunities, we wouldn't have to be using so many resources to test industrial chemicals that provide the greatest economic benefit. So I think this is just maybe a comment saying that if we could use risk assessment for pollution prevention opportunities. Would you say that would be something that could be addressed out of your system? So just using the information you get to get information about which chemical structures are leading to toxicity and maybe helping design those to be more green?
Yeah, I think this isn't exactly related to my presentation, but I think, most of the risk assessment paradigm is actually aimed at, so it's actually more like safety assessment. And so we're saying we're trying to assure that have an assurance of safety. But for comparative risk assessment, you really need sort of a different paradigm in terms of the end product. We want to say, well, is this riskier than that? And there you need to account for the fact that you have different data, you have different uncertainties, and you might have different variability across your different your two different alternatives, say. So if you have something that, has a very wide range of variability in terms of toxicity, then, that might be more concerning because you're going to have, there's a lot of susceptible people out there. But if you have something that is more tightly, has less variability, then maybe you could better manage that risk because you don't have to worry about sort of those tails as much. And, as long as you bring average exposures down or you limit average exposures, then you're going to be, you'll be adequately protected. So there is a sort of a connection.
No, and thanks, Weishui. That was a tough question to answer, and I think you did a good job answering it. And to the person who asked it, if you want more clarification, please feel free to reach out to us and we'll connect you with the presenters. So Weishui has agreed to stick around right till the end, so we will hopefully have some time at the end of the presentations if you have another question that you want to ask Weishui. If not, you can always send them on to us or reach out to him directly or we can pass it on. So thanks again, Weishui, and thanks again for hanging on. So the next presentation we have is from Dr. Michael DeVito. So Dr. DeVito is serving as the acting chief of the National Toxicology Program Laboratory. DeVito was most recently in the NTP toxicology branch leading the experimental toxicology group, where his group was characterizing the toxicologic and or carcinogenic potential of chemicals and agents nominated to the National Toxicology Program. He also served as a discipline leader for the NTP pharmacokinetic modeling efforts. So prior to coming to the NTP in 2009, Dr. DeVito was a principal investigator in the pharmacokinetics branch of the National Health and Environmental Effects Research Laboratory at the US EPA. From 2002 to 2009, he was chief of the pharmacokinetic branch. He served as one of the lead health effects researchers on the US EPA's dioxin reassessment from 1991 to 2009. DeVito's research interests include developing quantitative methods to understand the relationships between exposures to environmental chemicals, tissue dose, and toxicity for use in risk assessments. DeVito received a PhD in toxicology from the Joint Graduate Program in Toxicology at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey in 1992. So, Dr. DeVito, thank you for taking the time to put together your slides and present to us. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Okay, thanks for the introduction. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I thought I had to hit pound six or something. Okay, so today what I want to do is go over some of our work in high-throughput screening and mixtures and give you an idea of how that methodology can be used. See, I hit sync and go forward. So what I want to do is give you an idea of some of the challenges facing toxicology and hazard assessment, talk about TOX-21 versus ToxCast versus TOX-21 approaches. Now I'm sort of give you a case study on what we've done with some mixtures work. So I think we've all kind of heard this before. There's too many chemicals. We have thousands of chemicals on the market with significant toxicological data gaps. There's too many mixtures. Okay, what slide are you guys saying?
So Mike, you're still on the first slide. As a reminder, the bottom left-hand arrows, change the slide.
Okay, got it.
Yep, there you go.
Okay. Oh, it was changing on my screen. Okay, and then there's too many commercial mixtures out there to test. There's botanicals, there's different pesticide formulations. You know, if you're interested in glyphosate, there's probably 30 or 40 different formulations on the market. When you think about PAHs, there's a variety of different PAHs we're exposed to. And then when you think about all of that, we're actually exposed to mixtures of these mixtures. So we're not going to be able to use our traditional methods to test our way out of this. So I think in about the early 2000s, it became apparent to a number of organizations that our traditional tests were sort of unsustainable. And in 2004, NTP developed their roadmap to toxicity testing in the future. In 2005, TOX-21 was initiated with NTP, what was then the National Chemical Genomics Center, and the US EPA. Also in 2005, EPA initiated their ToxCast program. Around 2007, the NAS report came out about tox testing in the 21st century. And then in 2010, US FDA joined the TOX-21 effort. So for us, when we talk about TOX-21, we're really talking about the robot. Okay. And we're talking about running high throughput tests on large libraries of chemicals. We're going to focus on human biology, human cells, human tissues, but we've been screening 10,000 chemicals. So TOX 21 is really focused on large numbers of chemicals being screened. In phase one and two, we screened one pathway at a time and have looked at 75 to 100 different pathways for those 10,000 chemicals. Phase three, which we're beginning now, is looking at high throughput transcriptomics. So we'll be screening large numbers of pathways, looking at 3,000 genes at once. In our case at NTP, we're going to use the S1500 platform, which has about 3,000 genes in it. That covers about 94% of biology or the known pathways. So we're going to be looking at large numbers of pathways in one assay versus the phase one and phase two, in which we were taking about a week to query one pathway at a time. When you think about TOX 21 approaches, it doesn't require a robot, but it probably requires some liquid handling stations. You know, you're going to be using things, smaller libraries, maybe in a couple of hundred chemicals. You're going to be using liquid handling stations, and they're going to be probably more hypothesis-based screening. You'll look at more of a limited number of pathways, but you can also apply high-throughput transcriptomics. I think that the difference in the two approaches is one is really just focused on large number of chemicals, whereas TOX 21 approaches most people can do and many people can do in their labs and don't need the $5 million robot. So one of the challenges when we think about mixtures is we try to figure out how we can estimate human health risks from exposure to mixtures. And we've taken sort of two approaches. One is the whole mixture approach, which requires toxicity data on whole mixtures. And you're really trying to get the mixture of interest you're interested in. Or you may be able to use sufficient similarity approaches in which you have a reference mixture that you think is sufficiently similar to the exposure you're of interest. Alternatively, you can take component-based approaches in which you have data on individual chemicals that make up the mixture, and you use different mathematical approaches for addition to predict the mixture. So, for instance, you might use dose addition or a relative potency factor, or you could use response addition. At NTP, we've been spending a lot of time on sufficient similarity, particularly with the botanicals. But since this is a Superfund basic research program, I'll focus on our work on the component-based approach, which is looking at the individual chemicals within a mixture. Let me go back one. So our case study is going to be evaluating dose addition in TOX 21. What we did is we took chemicals that were positive in phase one of TOX 21 in the estrogen receptor assay, and we had 10 of those, and chemicals that were positive as androgen receptor agonists in the androgen receptor assay, and we have 8 of those chemicals. We wound up making about 67 mixtures of these 18 chemicals, and we used a RAID design. We have mixtures that are ER agonists only, mixtures that are AR agonists only, and mixtures that are a combination of both. Our number of chemicals in a mixture range from 2 to 4 to 5 to 8 to 10 to 18 chemicals. So we have a very broad range of mixtures. Some of those mixtures, the chemicals are at equal concentrations, some they're at equal potency, and some they're just of varying the ratios of the different chemicals. And then once we made those mixtures, we tested them in phase two of TOX 21. And we used two different assays. We used In this case, I'm just going to show you our results for the estrogen receptor assay. And we're just going to focus on what we call the BG1 assay, which is a estrogen receptor whole receptor assay. And I'll go into detail about that. But it was also run, these chemicals were also run in the partial receptor assay using beta-gal as a reporter. Here's sort of a list of chemicals that were active in phase one. For the ER actives, we had about 35 out of 1,500 chemicals that were active in the assay. We tried to stay away from the steroids and focus on environmental chemicals. For the AR actives, androgen receptor actives, we tried to do the same thing, but we were sort of limited by there were less chemicals that were active as androgen receptor agonists, and so we wound up with a number of steroid-related chemicals. Sort of give you an idea of the methods. The general method in TOX 21 is we have the plates are 1536 well plates. So we're running 15-point dose response curves for individual chemicals and the mixtures. The assays are performed in three consecutive days. So we run the assay three times. Our culture volume is about 5 microliters. So we're dealing with pretty small concentrations. Our assay came from UC Davis. This is Mike Dennison's lab. The cell line was originally classified as BG1. It turns out that on further analysis, it's actually a version of the MCF7 cell. So it's a mammary gland cell line. We treat the cells for 22 hours. Our readout is a luciferase reporter gene, so we're looking at luciferase activity. Our target here is a full-length receptor, and it's an endogenous receptor. And once again, it's a luminescent readout. This gives you an idea of running our positive controls in the assay and how well the assay worked. We before we run our test chemicals, we run our positive controls and negative controls through this a number of times, somewhere between around 20 to 30 times. You can see the EC50s come out to be fairly consistent, and our Z values are between 0.4 and 0.8, depending upon the assay output. So we think it's a reasonable assay to run. So like I said, we ran the chemicals, individual chemicals and mixtures at 15-point dose response curves, and we analyzed the individual chemical data to a Hill model. And then we, for the mixture models, we use an independent action or response addition or an integrated concentration addition independent action model. And that's from Howard and Webster, 2009. So to give you some of the challenges we found, I'll give you a heads up on some of the results. One of our challenges is, and I'll say, in for a penny, in for a pound. Once you're doing high throughput screening, you put the chemicals on the plate, and they're going to be run on every assay. So we have mixture data for these chemicals and mixtures for all 75 of the assays. I don't know if we're going to analyze that many, probably not, but it does pose a challenge with this. The other challenge with TOX 21 is there's sort of no going back. You know, you set up a library of 10,000 chemicals, you put them on the plate, and then you start your screening. And you're screening every other week, and you're going through using the robot, and so it's going pretty much full time. You're not going to go back and reanalyze, and you're not going to redo an experiment because one or two of the chemicals didn't give you a nice dose response curve, because you still have 9,998 dose response curves in that. And so you either get it right the first time or that's it. The other challenge is I think about it as a ship leaving port. So you're either on the ship when it leaves port, and once it goes, you don't go back to port and you don't get off the ship until it reaches dock. Same thing with TOX 21 and our 10K library. You're either in the library at the start of the study or you're waiting until we redo the whole, we start the next phase. And so there's really no going back and no sort of refining what you did. The other challenge we saw is that we had some data inconsistencies between phase one and phase two. All the chemicals tested were positive in phase one, but about half were positive in phase two for the estrogen receptor binding assay or the estrogen receptor assay. The other challenge we had is that all our concentrations of zuranolone wound up to being tested were at maximal response. And that causes a problem for dose response analysis. And sort of I'll give you an example of how the data turned out in phase two. So our as you can see on the left-hand side is the example dose response curve for zuranolone. We have the three different runs are there in the three different shapes of the data points. You can see the lowest dose is producing a 60-fold change in the response. And as you go up in dose, you start to see the response levels drop, and that's because we're killing cells with the zuranolone at those doses. So all the concentrations of zuranolone produced near maximal effect. When you looked at Alichlor, which was positive in phase one, what you see is there's no dose response. There's no response until you get up to about three-quarters of the way into dose response curve, and once again, you start seeing a decreased response, and we're seeing cell death there. So once again, this is our challenge with using high-throughput screening data to sort of do hypothesis testing and trying to deal with the issues of dose addition. Like I said, we fit our data to different Hill models, and then we use a variety of different dose addition models. So this is showing you here the general concentration addition model for all data points for all mixtures. The straight line going through would be if the mixture predicted the data. So on the x-axis, you have an empirical fit to the data. On the y-axis, you have the model fits to the data. And what you can see is there's some variance around the data. So we're going to go in and look at the different types of mixtures individually, sort of get a better idea of where we think the variance is coming from and what's going on. So this is for our predictions versus the data for just the estrogen receptor actives. And when you look at it, you see that we're actually not doing too bad a job in our predictions. Points that are to the left of the line demonstrate that we overpredict the response. Points to the right of the line suggest that we're underestimating the response. And I think at sort of the lower levels, we're not doing too bad a job with our predictions. We tend to maybe overestimate their response. When we get up to the higher doses, it appears we are underestimating the responses. When we look at our androgen receptor mixtures, what we find is that the low doses were actually underestimating the response, and at the higher doses we're overestimating the response. And this is posing a bit of a challenge for us, and we're trying to work our way through what's going on with this. When we combine the mixtures and we have estrogen receptor agonists and androgen receptor agonists in the mix, we actually don't do too bad a job at the low dose region. Once again, as we go up in dose and concentration, we tend to underestimate the response. I think we're all more concerned about the low end, and I don't think we're doing too bad a job there. One of the challenges, though, in the way I'm presenting the data here is that you have no idea of the variance on the predictions. So we tried to get at that here, where for all the mixtures we have, we're presenting it as a potency with a variance on the, and in the potency we're describing it as the Vmax versus the AC50. And we're giving you an estimate of our potency, both for how we fit the data to the individual data compared to how we the model fits of the mixtures. And what you can see is for the estrogen receptor, androgen receptor mixtures, we actually do it, they're in blue, we do a pretty good job of predicting the potency of that. We don't do too bad a job with the estrogen mixtures. They're in green. It's only really at the high responsiveness or highly responsive mixtures. We don't do that great a job. And then you can see we're not doing well with the androgen receptor mixtures, but there's a lot of variance around how we actually fit that data. And so they're not real potent and not real active, and so our fits aren't that great to that data. But that's really our challenge, is that the androgen receptor agonists were actually poorly predicted, but it's really has a lot of uncertainty around those predictions. So I just want to walk through a brief summary. You know, what I think is HCS can provide screening level information on biological activity. I think our mixtures containing ER agonists or ER-AR agonists were fairly well predicted in the low-dose region. Concentration response addition models underestimated the mixtures containing the AR agonists for their estrogen receptor effects. But our challenge there is that the AR agonists aren't very efficacious or potent, and we have a lot of uncertainty about model predictions of that data. And that's why you see that large variance in our predictions from the previous slide. We're still looking at this in the antagonist mode because a number of the AR agonists are actually AR antagonists, so we're trying to look at that data as well. The ER blah assay actually resulted in very similar results, and the ER blah assay is a partial receptor assay assay that uses a beta-lactamase reporter gene or reporter assay. And so it's only using the ligand binding domain of the estrogen receptor, and we get a similar results with that assay as we do with the ER luciferase assay. And then just want to point out that a lot of the data was analyzed by Fred Parham, Cynthia Ryder, and Ray Tyson. I designed the studies. Brad Collins was a chemist working with us, and Rayleigh Wong and Menghong Jia were at NCATS, which used to be NCGC, which ran these studies. And I'm done.
Many thanks, Mike. Good presentation. We've had a few questions come through the Q&A pod, so we'll get started with that. The first one was more of a nitty-gritty question, and this is in regards to case study one, evaluating dose addition in TOX 21. The question was, were the concentrations tested in a molar range for this study?
So what we did is we looked at the available data from phase one, looked at the AC50s, and made mixtures as a percent of the AC50. And so that's how we kind of based our top concentration of the mixture, and then we just did serial dilutions of that. And so we did analyze the data based on a molar concentration, not a milligram per milliliter.
Okay, thank you. Other questions that have come up are surrounding this idea of mixtures. So one of the questions was, considering the value and considering cumulative exposure. So looking at chronic exposures, you mentioned that in your addition model with mixtures that you were finding that with the high dose that you were underestimating. So when you consider several different kinds of exposure at low dose, would this still represent an underestimate? So is there value at looking at cumulative exposures or mixtures?
So what I would say what was for the estrogen receptor agonist mixtures and the combination estrogen and androgen receptor mixtures, what I would say is that in the low dose region, dose addition worked pretty well. And so even though some of these mixtures, particularly ER, AR mixtures have 18 chemicals in them. And so the fact that we're actually predicting that mixture fairly well, and it also has a fair number of really active chemicals and chemicals that didn't do anything in the assay. So the fact that we're predicting them in a low-dose region gives me confidence that most of our risk assessments are assuming dose addition, are health protective. I think when we get up to the highly responsive and high dose effects, I just hope we're not there. You know, I'm not sure when you're that high in effect, and I'm not sure we're really doing a risk assessment. I think we're doing an emergency response. It's more of a, you know, those type of exposures would wind up being from a spill or something.
Okay.
Because,
and that's,
you know, we're at near maximal response to the assay.
No, that's good to put it into perspective like that. Also, were you, so in terms of, this is also building on a question that was asked from of Wei Shui, looking at the, how are you considering metabolites? So when you're looking at these chemicals, are you looking at the metabolite form or is it just the chemical form? Or, and does that matter for your study?
So one of the challenges to TOX 21 is that a lot of these cell lines have limited metabolic capability. We're actually evaluating the metabolic capability in all the TOX 21 cell lines. Most of them don't have most of them have very limited phase one metabolism. Interestingly enough, they actually have a fair amount of sulfation, particularly the BG1/MCF7 cells. So we know we get a lot of sulfation in these, and if your molecule gets metabolized through that pathway, it's actually pretty active compared to human hepatocytes. But the other metabolic activities, phase one or any microsomal activities, are really low in these cell lines. We have developed a liver cell line model, HEPARGs, that we're trying to, we're beginning to use in screening in TOX 21 that is, has very high metabolic capability. But in this particular study, this is probably just parent we're looking at. And that does pose a problem.
Thank you. I will also open this up to the phone lines. I know somebody raised their hand, so I think that there is someone who'd like to ask a question via the phone line. So if you just want to go ahead and unmute your phone by pressing #6. Can ask your question. And this is somebody raising their hand, Sarah. I'm not sure if you can see that too, but I hate to ignore this person because I don't know the technology.
They may just be in the webinar room. They're not necessarily on the phone line. But if you do have a question, just feel free to use the Q&A pod to ask that question.
Okay, and we've had another question that's come to the, is there any new evidence of arsenic carcinogenicity on rodents based on the work using, oh, this would be for Wei Shui, sorry, Mike.
No, that's fine, I can't answer that one.
Using the 37 different mouse inbred strains, while it's been consistently shown that arsenic is a human carcinogen, there is a persistent argument that arsenic is not carcinogenic in animals. I'm not sure, Wei Shui, if you can answer that.
Actually, I can. Arsenic is carcinogenic in rodents. Mike Walkies and Eric Tokar have shown that, but you need to do a perinatal exposure model. If you just dose adults, you're not going to get the tumors. When you dose them in a perinatal exposure model, you will wind up seeing lung tumors and one or two other types. And this was a study with, I believe, CD1 mice
that has been done at NTP.
So it's more the window of exposure versus a yes-no question.
Okay.
Thank you. If there's any, also, if you all have questions for both speakers, please feel free to enter into the Q&A pod, and I am seeing some questions come through. So we have a question about clarifying the statement about data inconsistencies between phase one and phase two. So Mike, this is for you. Is that only for these 18 chemicals used in your mixtures?
So phase one, I would say, was a learning experience. What we tried to base it off the pharmaceutical model, and we didn't do replicates. We ran one dose response curve, and we wound up in some cases getting a lot of interference from highly active wells to adjacent wells. And so some of our things that some of our chemicals that were positive in the ER assay were actually adjacent to estradiol. And then when we did phase two, what we did is we did it on, three separate days, and we rotated where the chemicals were on those days. And so there it was easier for us to spot sort of those flare-ups that caused false positives. Having the three-dose response curves actually gave you confidence that whatever you were looking at was actually not an artifact, whereas in phase one, it was just one shot, and because that's how pharma was doing it, and we were using that model, and we just found that it wasn't as accurate as we needed it to be. It was, you know, they're basically, pharma's high throughput screening is a different philosophy. They're going to throw a million chemicals on at one concentration, and either something's really hot or they don't care. Whereas us in Tox 21, if you're screening for toxicity, you actually care about the dose response relationship. And so I think we learned from phase one that we had to take a different approach than what pharma was doing, looking for new compounds.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Thank you. We had another question, and I believe this really is relevant for both of you. And that question is, can you point to any computational approaches that you find that are especially complementary to the high-throughput strategy approaches that were presented? And then connected with that, what kinds of questions can be answered only by these kinds of approaches that are hard to look at empirically? I guess, Mike, we'll let you go first.
Okay, so I would say the way we're using computational approaches is a complementary approach, and that is we're using some Q. So if we have I'll give you an example of our perfluorinated or PFAS project. We're looking at the perfluorinated chemicals, and we have 75 of them. All right, so first thing we did is we ran it through a QSAR model to tell us what's the likely biology that may be happening. So based on that, we sat back and said, wherever they hit, we said, okay, what are the in vitro assays that we can that would represent that biology? And that allowed us to narrow down the number of assays and the number of approaches we would need to take with that class of chemicals. Now, it's not that we actually believe the QSAR models and their predictions of toxicity, but what it does do, it allows us to sort of catch the weird stuff that might happen with some chemicals and evaluate it in vitro so that if we ever needed to go in vivo, we'd have some idea of what to look for. So we're using it as a way to sort of pick our in vitro assays to query a library on in more of a hypothesis-based screening versus we're going to screen all known biology for everything.
Okay, just to narrow it down. Wei-Fei, did you have anything to add with that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of, you know, application more directly to risk assessment as opposed to in terms of prioritizing, there's a couple of things. One is for our variability data, the 1,000 genome stuff, there was an NIHS Dream Challenge in which there people were challenged to develop models, QSAR or otherwise, to predict, you know, what the variability for a new compound might be, you know, so you don't have to do, you know, screening in 1,000 cell lines again. So QSAR can be used to sort of augment your data set or your data based on when you've collected a large amount of data that's more robust to build a model. And then on the other, on a sort of orthogonal axis, QSAR can be used to kind of, extend further upstream in terms of, you know, just in silico prediction. So we have this toxvalue.org website where we have implemented a QSAR model to predict reference doses or NOALs, regulatory NOALs. So kind of like even before doing in vitro, if you can get an in silico estimate for a reference dose that is adequate, you know, with, you know, its attendant uncertainties, if you can get, you know, an estimate that's good enough for your decision, you know, based just on, you know, a QSAR calculation of what a reference dose might be, then, you know, that's kind of your zeroth tier kind of information, and then sort of walk down to the, you know, to using in vitro, in vivo data, et cetera. So I think they're complementary, the QSAR stuff is really complementary in a couple of different dimensions to the high-throughput screening approaches.
Okay, no, that's great. And just Wei-Fei and Mike, we have the opportunity to put additional resources within the Kluwen site. So as people, if they want to view this archive, they can look at some additional resources. So if you haven't already included the URL for, you know, Wei-Fei, I know you specifically called out a database, feel free to send that along and we'll make sure that gets included. So many thanks for all of you for sending these great questions in. And it is, I'm 3 minutes past the time I'm supposed to do this concluding remark. So if you'll just bear with me while I go through these points that I have to. I just wanted to make sure that you're aware, as I just mentioned to Wei-Fei and Mike, about these related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's webinar, and as you heard, they might be adding some additional resources based on these great questions we received. So this actually stays with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. These seminars get placed in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. So also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask you to consider filling this out. We look at your comments and we continue to try to improve both the content and the delivery mechanisms we use for this. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's Kluwen webinars, please refer to kluwen.org website, so C-L-U-I-N.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter Tech Direct or follow Kluwen on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit SRP Risky Learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions, and you can also follow Superfund on Twitter. So with that, it's time to conclude our webinar. If you submitted an online question and we didn't get time to get to it, or I asked it incorrectly and you still need an answer, please pass those along and we'll make sure the presenters get them so they can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters by email. The email addresses are all on the seminar homepage on Kluwen. So finally, again, many thanks to Wei-Fei and Mike. I know these things take some time to put together and carve out time to deliver them and answer these questions. So we do appreciate the time you took. We also want to again thank the planning committee who very carefully designed the content for this particular series. Bill mentioned them earlier, and I'll say it again. We appreciate your time that you took to do that. And we finally would like to thank you all for your participation and those great questions that came through. And I'll just wish you all a great rest of your day, and thanks again for tuning in.